to, so I'm really...
But this is, yes, and the llama is just in the title. It's really about dog training again. So one of the advantages of being last is that I know what all the presentations that have come before me, and I know how my presentation ties into what has been said. And it ties into so many of the presentations that came before. In particular, I wanted to mention John's presentation. He actually even used a slide of an emotional support dog. Nope. Of an emotional support animal, and that animal was a pig on a plane, and the story was that the pig defecated on the plane. And the reason I understand for including, is John still here? No. But the reason I guess for including that slide and that tidbit of information in his presentation was to kind of show how this category of emotional support animal can be an example of kind of American political correctness gone wild. It's this kind of grotesque impropriety of the pig on the plane, defecating on the plane, that strikes us. And this is not what I want to do, and it's not that I'm saying that it's a good thing to have a pig defecate on a plane. What I want to do is I just want to question this idea that this is just pure political correctness, that it's just crazy. The second presentation that I am obviously talking to is Charlotte's presentation about what animals count as working animals. And Charlotte was talking about farm animals. I am talking about dogs and which dogs are working dogs and which dogs are not working dogs. Can we define it? Can we draw a line? Is it easy to draw that line? And to speak to your presentation, which came just before me, and to kind of answer that question that was asked, and I said I could potentially address it, is, for example, there exists a lay version of the kind of scent detection work that you were talking about for detecting cancer. And the lay version is something that you can do with your pet. It's called canine nose work. In the UK, I think it has a different name. In the US, it's called canine nose work. And you use exactly the same techniques to teach the dog to mark a particular scent. Usually it's cinnamon, it can be anise. So if you teach your dog using the same methods and get kind of the same kind of responsibility going on between the handler and the dog, but it's cinnamon, it's not a working dog. Mm-hmm. If you do the same thing, but it's cancer, it is a working dog, isn't it? So it's not just the training, the idea there, and this is what I want to question in this presentation, is that it's the training that makes a working dog. And we like to think that because it's an easy way of conceptualizing a working dog, but the reality is that this is not how it works. Now, this project, which might turn into something it might not, is really in a kind of stage of infancy, and it's an offshoot, a side project of a bigger project that I've been working on for several years. That is a genealogical account of pet dog training in the US. So this is my big thing. And of course, pet dogs are not working dogs. But as I kept working on it, I also kept encountering this issue of the emotional support animal around me, particularly as I was working in the US with many of my dog training friends, wondering about whether they should get emotional support animal certification for their dogs, and even considering this possibility myself, which I actually did not do. But anyway, the way that it relates to the topic of this meeting is through reflection on the changing definition of what constitutes work in the human companion-animal relationship and how the activity of training ties into these definitions. So the recent emergence of the category of the emotional support animal in the United States reveals how slippery the understanding of what constitutes work has become in an age where the work of dogs helping humans can no longer be quantified in terms of specific services rendered. On the one hand, the recognition of the effective labor of companion animals, to use a term popularized by Michael Hart and Antonio Negri in Empire and Multitude, but absolutely not in the context of animals, is certainly a positive development because both quantitative and qualitative research, as well as literary memoirs of service dog users, prove that the emotional support offered by animals is at least as important as the practical services they provide. However, the similarity in the effective labor carried out by special purpose animals, let's call them this way, and, well, regular pets, leads to controversy and accusations meted out against pet owners who abuse the system by registering their pets as emotional support animals. Additionally, the therapeutization of the companion animal, which is an underlying assumption of the conceptual frame in which the category of the emotional support animal can function, so the idea is that the animal, companion animal, is therapy, carries its own set of issues. My goal is not to postulate policy change or ridicule what some would call the political correctness of airlines that allow passengers to travel with alpacas or turkeys, although I revel in the ingeniousness of the New Yorker writer who tested the boundaries of the emotional support animal certificate she obtained online by flying with a pot-bellied pig, going shopping with an alpaca, a boa constrictor, and a turtle. So this is the alpaca in the drugstore. I also do not wish to join the legions of righteous citizens who make it a point to out and ridicule fake service dogs. This is an actual website. It's also a Facebook site where basically people take pictures of dogs that they believe are fake service dogs and serve them to the website, and then you can view them on the website. As a cultural studies scholar, I want to understand why this is happening, what cultural changes and what material conditions have brought about these tensions. Why are they so prevalent in the US, which, to the best of my knowledge, is the only country which fully recognizes emotional support animals? Now let me show you. Oh, this is the turkey on a plane, on a Delta plane. There have been numerous cases, instances of people who were either flying into the US or kind of cross border, who had these emotional certificates for their animals, and the certificates were not honored in a different country other than the US. It is basically just the US where this category functions. And there are lots and lots of accounts of actually people who have traveled to Britain with their pets, and they can get in because they get in on a British, kind of under the American rules, so they can get in flying with their pet in their cabin with them, because the pet was accepted as an emotional support animal in the airport where they boarded, but they cannot fly out because the animal is no longer an emotional support animal because the UK does not recognize this certification. Okay. While I do not want to get into the truly complex legislation regarding animals, therapy dogs, and emotional support animals, a brief chronological look at how these categories developed is necessary. In the US, as in many European countries, the official use of dogs to help disabled persons began in the late 1920s with the establishment of the first school training seeing eye dogs for the blind. It is only in the 60s that dogs began to be trained as hearing aid dogs. The training of assistance dogs helping disabled persons who were not vision or hearing impaired but lived with a disability that made it difficult for them to independently carry out certain daily tasks truly took off only in the 1990s. After the passage of the Americans with Disabilities Act, the ADA, which defined a service dog as any guide dog, signal dog, or other animal individually trained to provide assistance to an individual with a disability. Note the phrasing individually trained. Here, what is interesting about this infographic, which is not my infographic, as you can see, I'm just using it from a very popular handbook on animal-assisted therapy, I think it would also be interesting to kind of turn it around and see how it happens chronologically. So the reality is that assistance dogs or service dogs or guide dogs were the first category to develop. Then therapy animals come into use, and then and only then in the 21st century does this category of the emotional support animal slowly emerge. This is the definition. This is the U.S. Department of Justice guidelines for interpreting the Americans with Disabilities Act. And what I have bolded here is that service dogs are dogs that are individually trained to do work or perform tasks. In most cases, the dogs are trained by someone other than the handler and are then matched with a handler with whom they work on a one-to-one basis. What makes it possible to define them as service dogs is the work they perform in result of the individual training they received. The work is thus directly the result of training. No training, no possibility of defining what the animals provide as work. Work is identified in terms of quantifiable tasks performed by the dogs, for example, guiding the handler to the curb alerting the handler to a crying baby, retrieving an item dropped by the handler, marking a scent box with the scent of cancer, for example. This is not to say that these dogs, service dogs here, do not carry out what we would call affective labor. That is, roughly speaking, what is intended to produce or modify emotional experiences in people. This is Hart and Negri's definition from Multitude and an earlier one as well. But it is not the affective labor that they carry out that makes them working dogs. They have to do a particular task. As an aside, while Hart and Negri analyze affective labor mostly as representative of the immaterial labor that is characteristic of the current dominant mode of production, so late capitalism or post-industrialism or however we want to call it, feminist theorists have taken up the term and pointed out how affective labor has been gendered for ages. Within feminist theory, affective labor is to a large extent synonymous with care work, the immaterial and unpaid labor of women. However, to get back to our dogs, service dogs' classification as working dogs and their right to accompany their handlers to all public locations guaranteed by the ADA hinges on the practical services they are able to provide, not on their affective labor. Although this has become somewhat fuzzy in result of the recent emergence of psychiatric service dogs and their incorporation into the service dog category. This is a recent phenomenon. The use of dogs for sufferers of PTSD dates back only to the two most recent wars waged by the US, in Afghanistan and in Iraq. Such dogs are meant to provide skilled practical assistance directly related to the person's disability. In this case, the disability is a mental disability. However, when we look at the list of tasks potentially carried out by PSDs found in the guidelines of the Psychiatric Dog Service Partners Organization, the two most common tasks dogs are expected to perform are pressure therapy and tactile stimulation. Pressure therapy basically refers to a dog pressing against the handler's body with his or her own body. There are different levels of pressure therapy. While tactile stimulation refers broadly to offering one's body for petting. While these activities can be quantifiable as work tasks, it takes a lot of effort to do so. To go back to the care work analogy, technically, we could classify a guardian comforting a crying child by giving the child a hug as performing the work task of pressure therapy. Yet we do not, because there is no little incentive for us to do so. It will not change anything. Potentially, attempts to qualify the effective labor of loving one's children could actually bring down the labor's social prestige. A mother is supposed to be selfless, after all. That is a different story. In the case of psychiatric service dogs, the purpose of quantifying care tasks is securing the dog's status as a working dog, which can happen only if the behaviors are conceptualized as resulting from the process of training. Consequently, the privileges of access granted to service dogs by the ADA are extended onto such an individually trained dog, therapy dogs. I'd like to keep the issue of therapy dogs only as a side issue to the main argument I am making in this presentation, but I cannot omit it altogether. In the late 70s, dogs also began to be used for what is referred to as therapy work, first in work with autistic children, as John talked about yesterday, visits to hospitals, nursing homes, etc. The uses of therapy dogs have been steadily expanding. Now that we have had therapy dogs again. In the past decade, the sites where one can interact with such dogs have begun to include university campuses, where therapy dogs help students deal with their pre-examination stress, sports stadiums. Okay, this is university campuses, sports stadiums, where therapy animals help stressed athletes before a game. Airports, where therapy dogs help stressed travelers. These dogs are trained by their handler guardian, who does not directly benefit from their therapy work. Therapy dogs do not automatically retain their privileges of access to public spaces while not working, and are not covered by the ADA Act. While there exist multiple organizations offering testing and certification, Therapy Dogs International is the best known one. In the test for future therapy dogs, they are required to demonstrate basic obedience skills, walking on a loose leash, a basic recall on a long leash, sitting, staying, as well as compliance with being petted, which to me is one of the most important tests here. And it's interesting how this is phrased. They demonstrate that the animal can be made readily accessible for petting. So this is a test that a dog has to pass in order to become certified as a therapy animal. Okay. A closer analysis of the news articles on therapy dogs mentioned previously and of multiple other media tidbits on the phenomenon reveals that the dogs that are the most popular as therapy dogs are the ones that allow themselves to be touched while expressing signs of visible pleasure resulting from experiencing the human's touch, which the beneficiaries willingly interpret as love. Oh, he likes to be loved on. The capacity of the dog to offer love is seen here as unrelated to the pre-existence of any kind of a relationship between the human benefiting from the love and the dog providing it. It is seen as a species characteristic of canis familiaris. It is also assumed that the affective relationship created in the encounter is meant to be transient from the outset. It is clear that the work carried out by therapy dogs can be interpreted as affective labor. The therapeutic benefits are not directly related to the skills tested for in the certification program, but mostly to what we would call, after Hart and Negri, the dog's pro-social skills. Regardless of the training the dogs receive, temperament, a characteristic considered inborn and not really modifiable in an individual dog, plays an important role in the success of a dog both as a service dog and as a therapy dog. It's a topic that comes up in multiple discussions about the sources for the acquisition of therapy dogs, breeding programs, and whatnot. Emotional support animals, though, which is really the main topic of this presentation, it's a queer category for many reasons. Thank you. Firstly, the ESA was never formally legally defined in a single piece of legislation, but rather comes out of casework that tests the limit of other pieces of legislation, specifically the definition of disability and reasonable accommodation in the Fair Housing Act and the Federal Air Carrier Access Act. According to the Fair Housing Act, housing cannot be denied on the basis of disability, and the landlord is required to make reasonable accommodations for persons with disability. A verdict in a 2000 California case stated that animals are used for emotional support by persons with animals used for emotional support by persons with disabilities are covered by the Fair Housing Act, and landlords have to lift their no pet policies for such animals. Similarly, the 2009 Federal Air Carrier Access Act extends the definition of reasonable accommodations for persons with disabilities to the presence of emotional support animals, which is how we end up with these pigs on the plains, because it's an emotional support animal. The idea behind it was to include cats, but of course animal is a very broad category, as we all know. An emotional support animal is defined as a form of therapy prescribed by a medical professional to someone with psychological health problems. A psychiatric service dog, it would seem, serves the same purpose. Technically, the only difference is in the training the animal receives to make it certifiable as a service dog versus as an emotional support dog. Now, this is from an article about the differences between emotional support and so on, a kind of very technical. So these dogs do not undergo particular training. It's the natural, untrained behaviors of the dog that help mitigate the individual's disability. So the mere presence, specifically the possibility of tactile stimulation provided by the closeness of the animal, are seen as therapeutic in itself. This is not surprising, bearing in mind the explosion of sites where therapy animals can now be encountered. In one of the few theoretical texts that do not focus solely on establishing boundaries between the different categories of service animals, Andrea Lawrence Simpson postulates that the emergence of this category is tied to the increased pharmaceuticalization of life itself and of companion animals. The mere presence of the animal is a form of complementary therapy. In a way, thus, the emergence of the category seems progressive in that it is one of the first instances where US case law recognizes the effective labor carried out by animals. It's a recognition that just being there and being available for physical touch is already a form of labor. No need for the mental calisthenics required in assigning work tasks to psychiatric service dogs. However, as is the case with much immaterial labor, this recognition does not carry with it the same privileges as the recognition of material labor does. An ESA is still not categorized as a working animal. It's technically, at least, still not afforded access to all public spaces, just housing and planes. There is an internal contradiction at the heart of this distinction between a service animal and an emotional support animal. On the one hand, it is the training received by the animal that makes it capable of real work on behalf of the human. On the other, there is supposedly something in the nature of non-human animality that is therapeutic in itself. Recall the natural, untrained behaviors of the animals in Taylor's definition. Training is somewhat like the addition of culture to the animal's nature, but there is also the assumption that it is in the animal's nature, particularly that of a dog, although it can be also other species, to selflessly offer love to other humans. It is not surprising that the emergence of the ESA has led to accusations of people passing their pets off as ESAs. And I think this is particularly important in America, where the distinction, where there are such strict regulations about where you can take your animal in public. So for example, this is the website, or screenshots from the website of Amtrak, the rail company that serves the US, which says, oh, we're so dog friendly. Well, yes, they are, but, okay, it's dogs up to 20 pounds in a carrier on selected routes and after you pay a special fee. You cannot take your dog on the subway or on buses in most major cities. U.S. has a law, U.S. has a law that says that the dog must, if you are to take your dog on a subway, the dog must be carried in a bag. So this is what people do in order to be able to travel with their dogs. Okay. So in other words, the U.S. has this kind of very segregationist attitude, not integrationist, in terms of the presence of dogs in public space. No dogs on buses, no dogs on trains, no dogs on the subways. This is all banned. Now, we laugh at these people for getting the ESA certification so that they can travel with their dogs, so that they can take their dogs into public spaces. But I think that, in all honesty, it's understandable, because as compared to the UK, as compared to Western Europe, Eastern Europe, Central Europe, this is just very restrictive, and it's a way of dealing with those restrictions. However, I also think that the emergence of this category brings these tensions to the surface and kind of promises to blow them up. Finally, you start seeing these animals, weird animals, in unexpected places. But maybe what is queer in this image is the subtitle, really. The subtitle here is, why are so many animals in places where they shouldn't be? Maybe it's not the alpaca in the drugstore that's queer. Maybe it's the subtitle, this assumption that she shouldn't be there, that an animal has no right to go into a drugstore. Okay, but I know it's like, of course, I should have finished, and I have not. I'm about to drop it to end it. But the deal is that still, what I wanted to show is that ESA is this kind of, to me at this point, it's a kind of transgressive liminal category of a dog that is, of an animal that is, has a kind of in-between status, and has the potential, because of its in-between status, to reveal certain contradictions that are inherent to American society in particular. Okay, thank you.